Good morning. President Trump backs away from strikes on Iran and once again says a deal is close. The AP tells us what to make of this whipsaw week.
There was just this feeling that, for all intents and purposes, this idea of a ceasefire had become rendered meaningless.
Why one European country may vote to cap its population, and how a Supreme Court justice came to draw upon the Founding Fathers' drinking habits in an important case. It's Friday, June 12th. I'm Gideon Resnick, in for Shimita Basu. This is Apple News Today. It was a day that began with threats of escalated strikes and ended with optimism.
We just made a great settlement of the war with Iran, and we're going to be subject to finalization of documents. We should get done over the next few days.
President Trump spoke with reporters from the Oval Office about the makings of a deal that would end the conflict that is now stretched into its fourth month. He didn't expand much on the details, but said that when an agreement is signed, potentially as soon as this weekend, the Strait of Hormuz would reopen. It's far from the first time that the president has leveled threats against Iran, only to reel them in and promise an approaching end to the war.
There is a huge amount of skepticism that this is a Groundhog Day moment because it's happened several times.
Amar Madhani is a White House reporter for the Associated Press.
That is the huge caveat, that this could fall apart just like all those other times when Trump has said, I am on the cusp of a deal. We're just going to have to wait and see if this happens.
To that end, Iran said on Thursday that it had not reached a final decision on the agreement, despite the fact that Trump said he believed that Iran's new supreme leader had approved it. The announcement from the president came after a dramatic week of escalation that seemed as though it could draw Iran, Israel, and the U.S. back into a significant armed conflict in the region. Last night would have marked the third day of U.S. strikes on Iran following the downing of an American helicopter in the Strait of Hormuz on Monday. Madhani said the president suggested that retaliation had made an impact.
The question he got over and over again is, what's different now? And the best answer he could give of what's different now is they've taken a pounding like very few other people could take, and they just simply want to make a deal, and they want to make a deal even a lot more than I do.
Ultimately, President Trump said that any deal has to ensure that Iran cannot develop a nuclear weapon, something it denies it's trying to do. And in turn, Iran has stated that it wants lifting of international sanctions, the release of billions of dollars in frozen assets, and recognition of its control of the strait. Madhani said what could be agreed to next year is essentially the start of an even harder conversation.
The idea would be to get maybe a 60-day extension, as something they've talked about in the past, and that would give them the time to focus in on some of the really important issues on Iran's nuclear program and the U.S. and Israel trying to get answers and trying to be sated with their concerns, essentially the justification for why they started this war to begin with.
There are also domestic economic pressures at play, with rising inflation and the prospect of continued high gas prices as Americans travel over the summer. So as much as negotiating may have been successful, it's possible that grim economic numbers could be moving the needle.
This was a war that he promised would last 4 to 6 weeks, and now we're talking about reaching into maybe a fourth month. And he may be right that the pounding is taking effect on Iran, but there is also a political pounding that seems to be taking place here in Washington, and that may be inching this along as well.
Voters in Switzerland will head to the polls this weekend to decide if the country will be the first in the world to cap its population.
And compared to previous initiatives, this one has really struck a nerve.
Jesse Ujevska-Stevens is following this election for The New Yorker from Switzerland.
It brings together debates over immigration, the rapid pace of population growth because Switzerland is such an attractive destination, and discontent over what is framed as the consequences of that growth.
Switzerland's population has grown by over 25% since the year 2000, with immigration accounting for most of that increase. The Conservative Swiss People's Party, or SVP for short, argues that growth is straining housing, transportation, and public infrastructure. So the party wants to cap the population at 10 million until 2050 to preserve what it says is Switzerland's long-term sustainability. The SVP has proposed two ways to keep the country below that threshold. First, if the population surpasses 9.5 million, the government would be required to restrict asylum seekers.
And critics have pointed out that this seems both harsh and unfair, given that they are such a small proportion of the population and are not driving the population growth that the initiative ostensibly aims to target.
Last year, just over 7,000 people seeking asylum were granted a refugee permit in Switzerland, a small portion of the country's net migration, which is roughly 80,000 people a year. If the population surpasses 10 million people for 2 years in a row, then the government would be required to block citizens of the EU from living, working, and studying in Switzerland without a visa, and to limit Swiss residents from doing the same. Now, that could dramatically reshape the country's economy.
Throughout the 20th century, Switzerland became one of the wealthiest countries in Europe. And this success, this prosperity, has largely been the product of being such an attractive place for foreign workers. So were that agreement to be canceled, it would have cascading effects on the other bilateral agreements. And that would be a major rupture for those relations.
One labor economist told Ujevska Stevens that this could jeopardize all of the EU's agreements with Switzerland, which is significant as the EU is Switzerland's closest partner in trade and security. The Swiss government opposes the measure and, in fact, implored people to vote against it earlier this year. But since Switzerland has a direct democracy, voters will get the final say. And it's been gaining popularity in recent months. In one survey conducted in April, 52% of respondents said they support the measure. That's up from 45% in March.
This language of presenting this population cap as a solution to unchecked growth itself seems to be resonating with a wider spectrum of the population than your average initiative that is simply more aimed against foreign migration. And I think that one thing that is interesting or illustrative for other wealthy democracies is this messaging suggests perhaps that the standard sales pitch for immigration, that it boosts the economy, might not be as persuasive as it once was.
June is typically the busiest month for the Supreme Court, and this year is no different. The justices have many consequential cases left to decide this term. Among them, the legality of mail-in ballots, gun rights for drug users, and birthright citizenship. But what's notable about this term is how more and more obscure and sometimes bizarre historical arguments have made it before the court in the name of a legal philosophy known as originalism.
Originalism is the belief that the meaning of the Constitution's words, the meaning of its text, doesn't change over time.
James Remoser is the Supreme Court reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
So the meaning of the Constitution's provisions when they were ratified is what they should mean today, and that's how the Supreme Court should interpret them in modern times.
Originalism isn't a new concept by any stretch, but Remoser reports that the court's current conservative majority is embracing it with gusto. And that's meant that lawyers on both sides of cases are turning into de facto amateur historians in order to help support their arguments.
Things like dictionary entries from the 19th century, or obscure newspaper articles, or legal treatises written in the 1700s or the 1800s to try to figure out what people at the time understood to be the meaning of certain statutes or of certain constitutional provisions. They really have dusted off all kinds of arcane evidence.
Several arguments this term have devolved into theoretical and academic debates over what historical sources actually mean. That came up in oral arguments in U.S. versus Himani, the case where justices are considering whether people who use illegal drugs should be allowed to own guns. The challenge for an originalist approach here is that drug use and addiction was not widely understood in the 19th century. And so Justice Neil Gorsuch reached for another example.
John Adams took a tankard of hard cider with his breakfast every day. James Madison reportedly drank a pint of whiskey every day. Thomas Jefferson said he wasn't much of a user of alcohol. He only had 3 or 4 glasses of wine a night. Okay? Are they all habitual drunkards who would be properly disarmed for life under your theory?
His argument there is if being intoxicated disqualified a person from gun ownership, some of the very people who wrote the Second Amendment might be in that group. Advocates for originalism say that these kinds of arguments, even if they appear strange, are the only way to ensure that modern justices don't infringe on constitutional rights. The legal philosophy is also being applied in President Trump's efforts to end birthright citizenship, long believed to extend to any person born on U.S. soil as enshrined in the 14th Amendment.
They're taking a very contrarian view. And their argument is that the 14th Amendment actually has been misunderstood all along, and that the original meaning of birthright citizenship in the 14th Amendment was never to extend citizenship to the children of undocumented immigrants.
To defend the position, the administration has used artifacts, including an 1881 document from a Confederate officer trying to deny citizenship to Chinese immigrants, and another unsigned letter purportedly written by President Andrew Johnson.
They are dusting off a number of quirky historical sources to try to make that point. And I use the word quirky because that's the word that Chief Justice John Roberts used in the oral arguments when he was grilling Trump's Solicitor General about the historical sources that the administration has marshaled.
Ramoser notes that Roberts is the only member of the conservative majority who does not identify as an originalist, despite the fact that he is a history buff. Here's a few other stories we're following today. Amid a firestorm over his last election, President Trump nominated a permanent replacement to be the next director of National Intelligence. Jay Clayton, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, was named after members of both parties revolted over Trump's prior temporary pick, Bill Pulte, a housing official with no intelligence experience. Pulte's appointment had stalled efforts to renew what is known as FISA, a federal surveillance authority. Lawmakers left Washington yesterday after rejecting a short-term extension. Clayton is a former Securities and Exchange Commission chair and came recommended by CIA Director John Ratliff. While some Democrats praised the selection, others said that Trump would need to remove Pulte in the interim. The Senate Intelligence Committee scheduled a hearing with Clayton for next week with the aim of filling the permanent spot soon. El Niño has officially begun. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration confirmed the phenomenon's presence, which is marked by a warming of the Pacific Ocean near the equator. El Niño has the power to affect weather patterns around the world, likely driving higher temperatures and exacerbating flood and drought conditions. NOAA said that this year's pattern could be strong enough to rank among the largest events on record, leading some scientists to declare it a potential super El Niño. Weather outcomes vary by area as a result of El Niño. For example, the Middle East could see some relief from drought, while places in the Pacific like Hawaii are at an increased risk of hurricanes. The pattern typically peaks in winter and causes higher temperatures the following year. The previous El Niño, in 2023 and 2024, coincided with the two hottest years on record. And finally, tonight, the U.S. men's national team will play their first official match in the World Cup group stage against Paraguay. It'll take place in Los Angeles. Brendan Hunt, who you might know from Ted Lasso and one of the hosts of the Apple News original podcast After the Whistle, says that along with winger Christian Pulisic, there are two other U.S. players that he'll be watching closely.
Two players who are in the spine of the team who are both immensely important and also a little bit injury prone, which is the central midfielder Tyler Adams and the central defender Chris Richards. Those two guys are just phenomenally, phenomenally important.
Hunt says he feels pretty good about the U.S. team's chance of making it out of the group stage, where they will also play Turkey and Australia.
To not get out of the group stage, which is not impossible. You know, the U.S. doesn't have any mugs in their group. There's no tomato cans. Like, there's no all-star teams either, but it's a low ceiling but a high floor. So it could be tough, but I'd be pretty surprised if they didn't make it out.
Beyond that, it's hard to know exactly how the U.S. men's team will fare. But to hear more from Hunt on the team's chances, the players to watch, and why a deep run could bring the country together, check out this week's episode of Apple News in Conversation. If you're listening in the news app, that is queued up to play for you next. If you're listening in the podcast app, you can follow Apple News in Conversation to find that episode, or just come back to the Apple News Today feed tomorrow. All new episodes of In Conversation will be available there on Saturdays as well. Enjoy the weekend, and I'll be back with the news on Monday.